Yeah, I'm actually going to record the opening Q&A too. So we got that started.
Okay. We'll give it just another minute and a few seconds anyway to get some
more. Sounds good. And I'll get the keynotes loaded up.
You got your screen set up, Hugh?
I got it all set up.
Okay. Well, we have some people already on. It looks like it's a good time to get started. So we already have a single question up. Nope, we get two of them up. Welcome to everybody who's on right now. We have about eight people. I expect the number to rise. Good morning or good evening to you, depending on where you are. And during this 15-minute period, your host will field questions that relate to whatever you want to have answered. And so we'll get that going, and then at about 10:45 Pacific Daylight Time, Hugh will start his lecture, and when he finishes his lecture, there'll be another Q&A. So with that, Hugh Stephen Posta asks the question that was left over from Sunday. Pictures from the Juno spacecraft show Jupiter's moon, Europa, having plumes of suspected water gushing from the surface of that moon into space. This has led to the theory that there may be large underground oceans of water supplying these plumes. Would these oceans be freshwater or saltwater? And which is the most commonly found water type of water in the solar system?
Okay, those are good questions. And Jupiter's moons do have a lot of water. Let's see, I think the record is Callisto. It's like 65% frozen water. Europa is about 35%. Ganymede does have some. So this is kind of interesting. They were wondering just how much frozen water it had. Apparently it's got sufficient to get these kind of geysers going. The fact that you see geysers coming out means there is interior ice. So this proves there is interior ice. How much interior ice there is, that's a question. And whether there's a huge part of the interior that's interior ice remains to be seen. What can really identify exactly how much interior ice you got, how much of the interior ice is in the form of liquid water or slush, that can be determined fairly inexpensively simply by having a satellite orbit, you know, artificial satellite, a spacecraft orbit that particular moon. And that's something that, you know, different countries are thinking about. Sending spacecraft to both Mars, or pardon me, to both Jupiter and Saturn with the goal that they would actually orbit the satellites or moons of these planets they're most interested in and determine the quantity of interior ice and how much of that ice is in liquid form. That has not been done yet, and I've been on record as recommending that those kinds of missions need to precede any attempt to land on those satellites, drill through the exterior ice crust and see what's in the interior. A much cheaper way to find out what's in the interior is simply to put spacecraft in orbit, because you're measuring the gravity of the planet or of the moon, and that tells you what's going on inside. So, but it's quite common for the moons of Jupiter and Saturn to have these geyser events. This is the first one that's been seen on Ganymede. And they're going to be monitoring to see if there's more. If all you get is one geyser, that probably indicates that there's only a local supply of water underneath is being heated up to a sufficient degree to give you a geyser. And so they're going to be seeing just how many more there are. If you got a follow-up question, I'll be happy to take it.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that we don't know what that water has in it. We just know it's water.
Oh, we don't know. Yeah, we just know that it's water. I mean, it's going to have some saltiness to it because it's coming up from the interior. Exactly what those salts are, we don't know. What the concentrations are, again, we don't know. One way to find out, however, would be to do spectroscopy on the geyser. that were to be done, then we could answer that question in detail. And that may happen in future observations.
Great, thank you. Juven from the land of the windmills, Netherlands. Says, Dr. Ross, the Bible describes the advent of humanity through Adam and Eve, but the common belief, even among secular atheists and history textbooks, is that Hinduism is the oldest religion. How do we respond to such claims?
Well, it's an old religion that has a written record. That doesn't mean it's the oldest religion. It's one of the older ones where we can actually establish some written record of it. And I actually looked at Hinduism because I was raised in Vancouver, British Columbia, where a fair number of Hindus were in our neighborhood and at public school. But what I noticed is that it got the cosmology completely wrong. And I also saw that it was a religion that was strongly promoting the idea that everything reincarnates based on the principle that the whole universe itself reincarnates. But in the Hindu Vedas, they actually declare what the reincarnation period is, 4.32 billion years. And we know that the universe is older than 13.7 billion years without any kind of such event. We also know that the universe has far too great an entropy measure to prevent any kind of possible rebound like you see in Hinduism. So that was one of the reasons why I felt that Hinduism was not the appropriate religion for me. Also, this idea that there's millions of gods that are all involved in creation. And when I looked at science, it really indicated that it comes from a single mind with a single purpose. And therefore this idea that you've got millions involved in some complex way. I mean, that's why in Hinduism, for example, there's the expectation that the record of nature will be filled with inconsistencies and incongruities, but that's not what we see. So, and you know, there's also been speculation that because the religions of the Sumerians and the Akkadians were in written form before the Bible was in written form, that somehow those religions gave birth in some distorted way to the Christian faith. We need to recognize that Hebrew did not become a written language until the 15th century BC. So that'd be the earliest time that you could have written recorded scriptures within the Hebrew culture. And what's interesting, the moment that Hebrew shows up as a written language, we immediately have scripture. The books of Moses, I believe, date back to the 15th century BC. So this to me is evidence that God wanted a written record for the Hebrew peoples as soon as that was possible.
Thank you. Doug McComb, one of the street preachers from Monrovia, says that in the 1999 Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society, Dr. William Lane Craig had stated that he was mystified by evangelicals' apparently uncritical acquiescence to positions that attempt to construe God as existing in hyperdimensions of time and space and to interpret Christian doctrines in that light. Apparently, at that time, William Lane Craig found those positions to be theologically and philosophically unacceptable. Have you responded to that statement, and how would you respond?
Well, actually, the thing to look would be at the Evangelical Philosophical Society Journal, because what you see in the Evangelical Theological Society Journal is an incomplete record of the exchange that was going on between me and William Lane Craig at that time, and it also involved J.P. Moreland. So what happened was, I was invited to give a lecture on fine-tuning at the Evangelical Theological Society, and Bill Craig and J.P. Moreland, and there was another one, he's now passed away, it was a Methodist theologian, trying to think of his name. Anyway, three of them were to give a response to my fine-tuning talk, and the Methodist theologian did indeed respond to my talk. Bill Craig and J.P. Moreland didn't respond to my talk at all. in spite of the fact that that was what they were invited to do. Instead, they took that as an opportunity to offer a critique of Beyond the Cosmos. It had just come out as a first edition, and so they both critiqued it. And main, the basis of their critique was this idea about, you know, trying to explain God's activities in dimensions beyond the dimensions that the universe is constrained to. They felt was a theological mistake. They felt that I was actually ignoring the transcendence of God, which was mystifying to me because that was very clearly stated in Beyond the Cosmos. Anyways, I actually gave a response, a written response. They came up with a written response to my book. I gave a written response and invited them both to give a written response to my written response. They said that was not necessary. They felt my written response to their critiques was more than adequate. They were happy with it. All that got published in the Journal for the Evangelical Philosophical Society. What got published in the ETS, Evangelical Theological Society Journal, was the transcript of the talk I gave on fine-tuning, plus the three responses, but they did not include my response to Bill Craig, counter-response to Bill Craig and J.P. Moreland. All that's on our website, however. If you go to reasons.org, we post the whole thing because the Evangelical Philosophical Society gave us permission to post that. So you get to see the full exchange there. What I did do in the second edition, because I had a private conversation with Bill Craig afterwards, and he said, well, now that you pointed out, I see all the qualifications I wanted you to put in the book, they're there. And I said, well, they're not only there once or twice, they're there in several places. And he says, well, I missed that. And so he recommended that in the second edition that I put those statements about the transcendence of the Creator much more frequently in the book than was in the first edition. So I did that. I had a response to that for a number of readers. They felt I was overdoing it. And one thing that also helped Bill too is I changed the title because I let him know I did not get to pick the title for the first edition or the second edition. But when it came to the third edition, they copyright returned to Reasons to Believe. And so we could choose the title we wanted. And so I put in that title, not only the trans or the extra dimensionality of the Creator, but the trans dimensionality of the Creator. So it's right in the title now. But on all three editions, it was present in abundance in all the different chapters of the book. So that's kind of what happened. And I find it unfortunate that the ETS declined to publish the response I put to both Bill and to JP, and felt that was somewhat unfair because, after all, that was sprung on me by surprise. They were supposed to respond to my fine-tuning paper, and I appreciated the EPS said, no, we really need to publish the whole thing. So that's the background. If Doug has got a follow-up question, I'll be happy to handle it. But I can tell you today, a lot of people interpreted that Bill was actually calling out my theological perspective. That was not the case. I can tell you that very day when he presented his critique and we talked afterwards, he was abundantly satisfied. And so the idea, and I think he was too also concerned that I was promoting Albert Einstein's definitions of time over Augustine's definitions of time. And part of the dialogue we had is to say, well, if you simply note that the dictionaries about time have changed over those 15 centuries, Albert Einstein's definitions are no different than Augustine's. And nothing that Albert Einstein was saying would in any way counter what Augustine was saying when he says God dwells in timelessness and spacelessness. What Augustine meant by that is that God dwells in a timeless, spaceless way, which is independent of the space-time dimensions of the universe. So there really is no contradiction. And Bill has made that very clear, especially in the last couple of years of his talks, that he's no longer claiming that Einstein's definitions of time are wrong. It's simply a problem about seeing how dictionary definitions of time have changed over the centuries. So I think everything's fine now. And by the way, I've been on stage with Bill multiple times as co-ministers. So this idea there's a conflict between the two of us, that's mistaken. We certainly have different beliefs on certain issues that are important, but we do minister frequently together.
Thank you, Hugh. We have one more question before we got to get started in the regular session. And it's from Camille. And Camille says, a girl after a car accident couldn't speak, walk, and all those things that we do regularly. Her face was changed. There was no way to contact her. And a few months later, she died. So the question is, after this kind of brain damage, is there really still a person in there? Can there be a person?
Well, it depends. I mean, if the brain stops functioning, then that means the spirit is no longer able to use the body, the physical body, in order to communicate with the outside world. And in the medical industry, as I understand it, that's their definition of death, when there's no possibility for the brain to ever recover sufficiently that it can control the body. They call that someone being brain dead. And that's the basis, for example, of being able to share organs. So, for example, if you ride a motorcycle without a helmet, you've got a good chance of becoming an organ donor, because your head may be damaged to a sufficient degree. Your brain can no longer be able to control the body. They call you brain dead, and they feel that it's quite appropriate to harvest the organs, mainly because I don't think there's any medical evidence of someone who's brain dead ever recovering. And therefore, they said, well, we might as well harvest the organs so they can do good for other people. I may not have answered the question to the degree that this person asked, Camille. So again, if she's got a follow-up, I think we need to get started. And so, but Camille, if you've got a follow-up, feel free to do so. I'm going to give a talk for 30 minutes, and we're going to have the rest of the time for Q&A.
Thank you, Hugh. That's perfect timing.
Okay, now, I thought so.
Yeah, we're now starting the actual time when Hugh Ross will be doing his presentation. I remind the people who are on now that when Hugh is done, we'll have a Q&A. We'll start with the questions that came between 10:30 and 10:45, which is a time for those of you who haven't made use of it, where Hugh will answer questions, that, particularly the questions that didn't get answers from the week before. So you can come in between 10:30 and 10:45 Pacific Daylight Time, and Hugh will answer the questions. So with that, Hugh, it's all yours, and when you're done, we'll do the Q&A.
Well, that sounds good. What we're going to do today is clean up everything that we haven't yet covered on human origins. There will be no review. If you are jumping in late, you can go to paradoxes.org, and the recordings of the previous weeks on our series on human origins are available there. You can download them at no charge. And that's the way it is for all the previous episodes of And just one quick announcement. We are thinking about what we're going to do when it's possible for us to meet in person here in Southern California. Those of you who live in other parts of the U.S. or overseas may not be aware that the Los Angeles County has been a real hotbed for this COVID-19. So we're going to delay being able to meet in person. But like it was before COVID-19, we're going to live stream. So this isn't going to change. All of you that are participating through live streaming, we're going to be able to do that afterwards. But as soon as we can start meeting in person, we're going to launch into the series that the church that I'm part of wants us to develop. And that is a series of short courses. Shortest would be 2-week series. The longest will be an 8-week series. And to actually look at the challenges that we get to our Christian faith in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. We've actually done that here in paradoxes.org. If you go back 6-7 years, we're going to redo that, but we're going to do it with all new material that we've been developing. So, and we've never really had a good chance to record this in a way where people can see all the visuals. So that's what we're going to do as soon as we can start meeting in person. what we're going to do in the meantime, today I'm going to clean up the series on human origins with the stuff we've not covered yet. And then we're going to launch into a short series dealing with my new book, Weathering Climate Change. Got several talks ready to do with that. One of them I'll actually be giving this Thursday as part of RTB Live. If you're not aware of that, every Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific time, the scholar team at Reasons to Believe presents a new message and takes questions somewhat similar to what we're doing right here. And my turn will be this Thursday. So feel free to check that out. Right now, I'm going to share a screen, and we'll get started with our 30-minute presentation. Here we go. And the only review you're going to see are MOOC slides, and we're going to jump into the new material. And again, this just is a reminder that if you don't get to answer your questions today, all of our scholars at Reasons to Believe do take questions on their Facebook and Twitter pages. And again, to remind you that Reasons to Believe has a 24/7 YouTube channel. If you just simply go to Reasons to Believe YouTube, it'll pop right up, and we're putting new videos there on a daily basis, and you can subscribe for free. And in terms of material, let me jump down here to where we're really, here we go. Sorry about that. Just a reminder, once again, you can get free chapters or books at Human Origins at reasons.org/Ross, reasons.org/Rana. And finally, we got things fixed up with our Human Origins workshop. You can now find it, not only by typing in the exact URL, you can find it on the reasons.org website. reasons.org/Human Origins Workshop 2020. But yeah, our search engine can find it through a variety of ways. We had a problem with that, but it did get fixed. So thank you, all of you, for alerting me to the fact that it wasn't working. It's now working. And let me jump into this content here. And I'm going to go through this fairly rapidly. And because some of this we've covered before, so I'm just going to zip through this. We've got different terms, cavemen. That's a term that's really no longer used, especially since we humans also sometimes live in caves. Cro-Magnon is used as well, because that term is basically identical to modern humans. The hominids or the bipedal primates is a term used to refer to non-human bipedal primates. Homo sapiens is different than Homo sapiens sapiens. Homo sapiens sapiens refers to modern human beings, to us. Homo sapiens also includes a number of other species of bipedal primates that are not human, so just watch out for that terminology. And in terms of the research findings, what we've been finding about these creatures, I mentioned last week that the Neanderthals and Denisovans had small local populations. That's actually true of all the bipedal primates. That is significant because it rules out any possibility that they were connected through one another by common descent. With populations that small and separated by significant geographical barriers, it really isn't conceivable by any naturalistic means that one of these species could be evolving into a distinctly different bipedal primate species. So just a reminder that yes, the populations were low. And this together with research that shows that terrestrial mammals with adult body sizes greater than 3 kilograms go extinct before they evolve. And of course, the smaller the population, the smaller the probability for any kind of evolution. This also explains why over the period of time in which we see these bipedal primates, that we don't see significant change. The populations were too small for there to be any significant microevolution going on. All of these species use simple tools. What I mean by that is they either use a piece of wood that they might have manufactured and shaped, or a stone that they might have manufactured and shaped, but you don't really see them connecting wood with stone tools, with sinews, to make things as complex as, say, a bow and arrow. The time scale with which these species existed, the earliest one is 6.5 million years ago. The most recent one is about 30,000 years ago, and that refers to Homo florensis in Indonesia. This is a creature is about 3.5 feet tall with a brain about the size of a chimpanzee, but fully bipedal and able to use tools. Of course, chimpanzees can use tools as well. And I need to emphasize this too. We don't see any technological advance within a species. We do see technological advance when you go from one bipedal primate species to a later bipedal primate species. So we actually do see some evolution and technological advance from species to species, but within a species, we have no undisputed evidence that they had any kind of technological advance taking place. So moving right along, we also note that the fossil record for the bipedal primates is not your standard naturalistic tree. Rather, it is a hedge in the sense that we don't see a common ancestor branching out into different species of bipedal primates. That's not what's taking place here. And I think we've mentioned this quickly before, so I'll mention it very quickly again, is that when you look at the progression towards a greater brain capacity, it goes up and down. It's not a linear progression. And likewise, you look at bipedal capability. It's not a progression. What we see is that it goes up and down. One species becomes more bipedal capability. The succeeding one could be less. I think one of the more dramatic examples of that is Homo florensis, where the brain cranial capacity drops significantly by about a factor of 4 from previous bipedal primate species, and the bipedal capability also dropped. But we see that in a number of other species as well. Incidentally, the one linear thing we do see, not exactly linear, but we do see a trend over the 10 to 12 species of bipedal primates that started 6.5 million years ago, ending 30,000 years ago. You do see somewhat of a trend that each succeeding bipedal primate species is more capable of hunting birds and mammals than the previous one, and especially the bigger birds and the mammals. And Neanderthals and Denisovans, some anthropologists believe, were exclusively feeding themselves on what they were able to hunt of large-bodied bird and mammal species. And nearly all new fossil finds add chaos rather than confirming the naturalistic models. That's admitted in the scientific literature. Quickly, who is this Homo sapiens? We're not talking human beings. They're basically a tropical Neanderthal type with a different body structure that's more designed for a warm climate than the body structure of Neanderthals, which was designed for a cold climate. The dates, 80,000 to 250,000 years ago. But like the Neanderthals, we see no evidence for symbolic capability, no undisputed evidence that they were involved in any kind of spiritual activity, and we don't see technological advance in the manufacture and use of their tools. With Neanderthals, we now have mitochondrial DNA. Neanderthals and Denisovans are the only non-human bipedal primates from which we have DNA that tells us anything. We actually do have DNA from earlier species, but it's so corrupted that it basically gives us no information about the genome of those species at all. These genomes decay fairly quickly. And even in the case of Neanderthals, the DNA we have at best is 2/3 complete, but we actually do have quite a bit of mitochondrial DNA from more than 20 specimens now. But as we look at that mitochondrial DNA, we can't measure any evolution in that DNA. And that DNA is distinct from human DNA, in which case it really does establish that Neanderthal is a separate species from us human beings. And we spent quite a bit of time talking about the evidence for its distinct morphology. You can get the recording. The morphology of Neanderthals What I mean by that, the body structure and the body plan is radically different from us human beings, basically ruling out the possibility that they could in any way have been part of the human species. There are claims that they were expressing symbolic capability, but nothing that's undisputed. And even the claims that they were having symbolic capability amounts to nothing more than linear scratches on a piece of stone, which could be caused by a number of other non-worshipful activities. Not a worshiper, no technological advance. We covered this last week, so let me just zoom on. Homo erectus. I didn't say much about this. I don't think I said anything about it. What's interesting is how long the Homo erecti species existed on the face of the earth. Some think they may have lasted till 100,000 years ago. Some also put it back to 2 million years ago, even 2.2 million years ago. But what is undisputed is that we have Homo erectus specimens that go from 200,000 years ago to 1.8 million years ago. But I think what's particularly interesting, over a minimum of 1.6 million years, we see no evidence for evolution in the morphology of these creatures. And again, there is DNA, but it doesn't tell us anything. But the morphology is distinct from both. They're radically distinct because they're slim, 5 feet tall, not a lot of muscle mass, which puts them in a totally different category than the Neanderthals and Denisovans, but also puts them in a totally different category than human beings. The brain capacity was about half of what it is for human beings and certainly lacked the parietal lobe. So this explains why we see no evidence for symbolic capability or technological advance. Okay, this is brand new material. And this again challenges the idea that there was some common ancestor between chimpanzees and humans that gave rise to all the bipedal primates and eventually to human beings. If you actually look at the nucleotide differences in the DNA of these different species, if you look at human beings today, and so we look at the, and this also includes DNA we've gotten from humans that have been dead for thousands of years, compare it with the average among humans today, and look at that average, we only see 30 differences. With Neanderthals, we see 202 differences. There's been some papers published where they claim that Neanderthals and Denisovans are one and the same species. This evidence challenges that because we see significant differences here between the Denisovan hominins. And by the way, we only have a couple of specimens of the Denisovans. It's not like the Neanderthals, but we got enough DNA that shows that their DNA is substantially different from the DNA of Neanderthals, and both substantially different from that of human beings. And then I put the chimpanzees down at the bottom. So this is basically making the point that these are distinct species and challenges this naturalistic assumption that they're all related through common descent. These numbers would dispute that conclusion. And a question that comes from all this is, well, if this is all God's activity, if indeed it's not naturalistic common descent, why would a good God, an all-powerful God, even bother to create all these species, and why create so many of them? And the answer, and this is not the only possible answer, but it is a answer, namely to prepare the large-bodied birds and mammals for the arrival of the ultimate predator. The ultimate predator is us human beings. We're the only predator on planet Earth that can kill anything we want. I mean, have you ever watched these National Geographic documentaries, say on lions and tigers, leopards, wolves? What you notice is that they have to get their food supply by feeding on the weak and injured and sick animals. They're really not able to kill. In fact, you can see in these documentaries, for example, where a group of wolves will surround a moose. But if the moose is healthy, the wolves back off. because they know that moose is capable of killing one or two or three of them, and so they will back off. But the reason why they surround the moose is to determine whether or not it's healthy, to determine whether or not it's injured to a point where it can't defend itself. This is different from us human beings, because we can actually hunt the best. And this is why we're in danger of bringing these species into extinction, because unlike the other predators, where they weed out the sick and the diseased, the injured, that actually helps the health of the herbivore species. By weeding out all those that are diseased, for example, you prevent the rest of the herd from getting ill. And so this actually enhances the health and the population of the herbivores. With us human beings, we can come in and kill the strongest and the healthiest of the males and females in the population. And we do that, we degrade the herd's capability of maintaining a strong, healthy, high population herd. And keep in mind, when you look at the book of Job, it tells us that God designed the birds and the mammals to relate to us human beings. And they have within them a desire to come to us human beings. And some species actually express that to a higher degree than other species. I mean, species, for example, have a very high affinity to human beings, a very high desire to relate to us, are certain bird species and certain mammal species. We wiped out the passenger pigeons because they had an extraordinary affinity for us human beings, and they would fly towards the hunters, ran away from the hunters, and so we wiped them out within just a few decades. Sad, because wouldn't it be great to have these birds around today that love to hang around us? It's also sad because they're actually the highest population bird species on planet Earth. We humans wiped out the highest population bird species on the planet, mainly because these birds were not trained by bipedal primates. You don't have bipedal primate species preceding human beings on North America. These passenger pigeons were in the Americas. And because they had not been exposed to bipedal primates, they did not have the training that told them, when you see tall bipedal creatures with weapons in their hands, run, fly away, don't fly towards them. And this is basically the rationale for why God would have created so many of these species. Also explains, too, that the one linear progression we see in these bipedal primates, each successive species is a little more capable of hunting birds and mammals, and especially large-bodied birds and mammal species, than the previous one. And here are some statistics that I think drives home this point. This is an extinction list, and it's basically showing us the percentages of large mammal extinctions when humans first showed up in these different continents. So Australia, like North and South America, didn't have any bipedal primate species that preceded human beings. And therefore, when humans entered Australia, they quickly drove 94% of all the large mammal and the large bird species as well to extinction. That also happened in New Zealand. South America didn't have any bipedal primates that preceded human beings. The extinction rate there was 79%, North America 73%, which raises the question, why was the extinction rate less in North and South America than it was in Australia? Simple answer, they're bigger continents. There's more places for these creatures to hide. What that means is that the humans entering North America, for example, were not able to easily get to all the large-bodied bird and mammal species, and so more of them survived than was the case in Australia. Because in Australia, they were basically living around the edge of Australia. That's where the humans entered and began to populate. And that also explains why the Aborigines in Australia were not able to launch civilization, get beyond a Stone Age technology until Europeans came and brought animals with them. And this comes straight out of the book of Job. And it comes also out of the creation day 6 in Genesis 1. Genesis 1 does not talk about when God created the first mammals, the first land mammals. Rather, it skips ahead in creation day 6 and addresses three specialized kinds of land mammals, the short-legged land mammals, the rodents, and then two different kinds of land mammals, those that are easy to tame by humans and those that are more difficult to tame by humans. And it's basically referring to the creatures mentioned in the book of Job, some by actual species name, that God created in order to make possible human beings launching agriculture and civilization in general. Australia actually had these creatures, but the humans came in there, wiped them out, and so they didn't have the camels, they didn't have the cows, the horses. Those creatures all got wiped out, the donkeys got wiped out, which means that the only animal that the Australian Aborigines were able to domesticate and put to use was the dingo. Everything else got wiped out, and if all you got is a domesticated dingo, it's very difficult to attach a plow to that dingo and be able to plow a field. You need big, strong land mammals that can be tamed by human beings, emotionally bonded by human beings, where they can plow up the fields. That was missing in Australia. Likewise, the same thing happened in South America and North America. The very species of life that were needed to launch extensive agriculture and civilization got wiped out. That didn't happen in Europe, Asia, and Sub-Saharan Africa, because those are places where there were a number of these bipedal primate species. And in fact, you have the full sample of them, almost a full sample, in Sub-Saharan Africa. And notice there the extinction rate when humans arrived was only 4.5%. So this explains why civilization was able to be launched, able to be exponentially increasing, because they had the very animals they needed to launch large-scale agriculture and civilization. And that's all thanks to the fact that there was this long history of bipedal primates basically training the birds and mammals, and especially the large-bodied bird and mammal species, to avoid contact with tall bipedals with weapons in their hands. And so that explains why, for example, elephants survived in Africa and Asia, but did not survive in North America. North America was filled with all these mastodons, but the mastodons were just so easy to hunt and so unwilling to run away from humans that they got quickly wiped out. And it was said that if you can kill a mastodon, you can feed your whole tribe for a couple of months. So again, the fact that it was such an easy supply of food for very little effort explains why they got quickly wiped out. Not entirely incidentally, this is just a little bit of trivia, the Canadian government still serves mastodon meat at state functions, because enough of these dead mastodons were actually flash frozen in place in the Canadian North, that they've been able to recover that, and the meat is still good to eat. So yeah, certain special state functions, they serve mastodon meat in Ottawa, Canada. But yeah, they're long extinct. I think the last one lasted about 3,000 years ago. Okay. In terms of what the scriptures actually say about Adam and Eve, again, I'm just not going to go through this because we covered this in detail, but just very quickly, the Bible tells us it was the final miracle of creation of life by God. It's the only spiritual beings that God created on earth, and they're the progenitors of all humans. And you know, again, if you want to go into this in some detail, we actually went through all the scripture passages in the Bible that dealt with human origins. But these are probably the three most significant things we can discern there. As far as a biblical date for Adam, some of you have been asking me about this. You know, how do you get a biblical date for Adam? And it's not the date that you get from a young earth creationist perspective. Genesis 2 tells us that God created Adam and Eve at a time when the four rivers mentioned there came together in the Garden of Eden. And they only come together when you have an ice age, because right now that location is more than 200 feet below sea level, but between 15,000 and 130,000 years ago, it was above sea level. So that gives you a rough biblical date, but we can also apply carbon-14. Carbon-14 dating is a reliable dating method that tells us that humans have been here for at least 40,000 years, perhaps 45,000 years. There's some DNA evidence that puts humans at least as far back as 45,000 years. Carbon-14 is not capable of giving us an earlier date than that because you're just too far away from the half-life. And once you get past 45,000 years, you get a background signal from the uranium thorium, basically impinging the natural nitrogen that exists and producing a background level of carbon-14. So everything you date is going to have a carbon-14 date of about 57,000-58,000 years ago, or 50,000 years ago, just based on the fact that you get all that uranium and thorium and potassium decaying, and when it does, it can convert some nitrogen-14 into carbon-14. Okay. I just want to share with you, this is what the Arabian Peninsula looks like today. And these are the biblical names that are mentioned. It tells us that two of the rivers that came together in the Garden of Eden came from the land of Asher, which today we would recognize as modern day Iraq. And we got the Gishon flowing out of the mountains of Cush, and Cush is down there at the bottom of the southwest part of Arabia. And then we've got the Pishon flowing out of the mountains of Havilah, where there is gold. And that little region there that I show in central western Arabia is the only place in the Middle East where you got significant gold deposits. And that we can actually use satellite imagery to see the dry riverbeds of the Gihon and the Pishon. The Gihon flows through southern Arabia, and the Pishon out of the mountains of Havilah. And they both meet just off of Qatar in the Persian Gulf. And they meet up with the two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, that are mentioned there. And this shows you what the Middle East looked like 40,000 to 120,000 years ago. And these are actually the locations. That little turquoise dot there shows you where the four rivers would come together, which today is more than 200 feet below sea level. And people have argued that maybe Eden refers to the whole world. It does not. It talks about as a place where the four rivers come together, and also makes the point that the land of Nod is to the east of Eden. And so probably somewhere in southern modern Iran is where the land is. But what I want you to see is that these mountains of Kush extended to Africa, because during the last ice age, almost all the Red Sea would be dry land. And therefore, there's actually three times. I mentioned this in my book, Improbable Planet, and it's also in Navigating Genesis, that there are three dates during the last ice age where you got an easy migration route from southern, from the Persian Gulf into Eastern Africa. It actually explains why we see artifacts, the earliest artifacts that we can attach to human beings, show up in the Persian Gulf area and also in Eastern and Southern Africa. But that makes sense, because today it's very difficult to walk across Southern Arabia. We call it the empty quarter because it's just filled with huge sand dunes. Extremely difficult to cross, extremely hot and dry. But there are three times when you've got the Gihon River flowing at a high rate, and therefore you'd have an easy migration route just walking along the river up into the mountains of Kush and over into Eastern Africa. And I'm trying to remember those dates. I think one date is about 117,000 years ago. One is 74,000 years ago. I think one is 58,000 years ago. So these all be evidences for a fairly early date, earlier than 45,000 years ago, because we need to come up with some explanation why we see the earliest artifacts showing up in the Persian Gulf area, as well as Eastern and Southern Africa. And you would need an easy migration route to explain why humans could get quickly from one place to the other, so the dates show up to be roughly the same. And for those of you that are interested, this is what I think happened when the Noah's flood occurred, that a berm that was at the Gulf of Hormuz broke. There's actually geological evidence that there was an ancient berm there that blocked the flow of Indian Ocean water into the Persian Gulf. And therefore, having the flood take place during the last ice age, you could have the berm break, and you could have all this water rushing in from the Indian Ocean. The text also tells us that there is water coming from the springs of the deep. And today we know there's a huge underground aquifer below the Persian Gulf. So when that was dry land, there would be this huge water aquifer, and some kinds of tectonic events brought that water up to the surface. Plus there is torrential rainfall. And so this gives you an idea just how extensive Noah's flood could have been if it did indeed take place during the last ice age with the breaking of a berm at the Gulf of Hormuz. What's interesting here is you get a flood that covers a region of the earth that's about four times larger than what you get in a traditional old earth creationist flood model. And this is extensive enough that it could actually wipe out the entire population of humanity that existed at that time, except for those on board the ark. And then as the ice age begins to end, we see that the Persian Gulf begins to fill up with water. It took a little bit of time. Same thing happened with the Red Sea. But what's really interesting, you get a land bridge joining Arabia to Eastern Africa that extends quite late into the last ice age. And some geophysicists believed that there is a land bridge that persisted even as late as 15,000 years ago, 14 to 15,000 years ago, joining Arabia to Africa, which means that you would have migration possible from southwestern Arabia into Africa until quite late. And also there'd be other land bridges that you could cross from Asia into Africa because of how much of the Red Sea would still be dry land. But eventually it looks like what it looks like today. Okay. So a quick review of all these biblical place names. And then as far as a biblical date for Adam, if you look at the genealogy, this is usually where people try to come up with a date. I've argued in Navigating Genesis, you do get a rough date, but it's got a huge error bar, 70,000 plus or minus 60,000 years. I think we actually get a little more accurate date, not from the genealogy in a Genesis 5 and 11, but rather from what we get in Genesis chapter 2, talking about the four rivers coming together. But this is two independent ways, and the dates do agree. And in terms of the scientific dates, these are the dates we get for the cultural Big Bangs, and there could be earlier dates than what we see here in this table. But these are the undisputed dates we have for the first origin of all these things that we would indicate would be signs that we got modern humans active on the scene. Namely that we see, we actually have evidence for clothing tools and clothing that dates back 40,000 years ago, jewelry, complex jewelry 40,000 years ago, bread making technology that exists 36,000 years ago, art and music, cave wall paintings. There is a recent paper pointing out that there may actually be evidence for art that goes back earlier than 50,000 years ago. That's been a recent paper that's been published, so I need to update this. As far as evidence for complex language use and complex tools 40,000 years ago, I wouldn't be surprised if we continue to do this kind of research that we push the dates back to say about 60,000 years ago. Particularly based on this new find about a cave where they found, this is in Asia, where they found art that apparently dates. But again, I want to remind you, that when it comes to, excuse me, that when it comes to dating anything earlier than 40, 45,000 years ago, the dating tools that we have give us, they all have significant systematic errors. So we have a tentative date for an Asian cave that dates back earlier than 50, 60,000 years ago, but it's tentative. I've got an article coming out, I think it's coming out this Monday, in my Today's New Reason to Believe. It's a 3,000 word article basically talking about the systematic effects of dating tools between 45,000 years ago, which is when carbon-14 ceases to be useful. Actually, 40,000 years ago is when it ceases to produce accurate dates. That explains the list of dates we see here at 40,000 years ago. That's when we cease to have accurate dates. And you don't get another accurate dating tool until you get to a quarter of a million years ago. So there's this gap between 40,000 and 250,000 years ago where we do not have any direct dating tool methods. We got these indirect methods that have very large systematic effects. I won't go into the details. Again, I got an article coming out, either coming out this Monday or next Monday, but I think it's this Monday that it's coming out. No, actually, it's going to be not this Monday, but next Monday. But that comes out, and it will actually go into every one of the dating methods we use between 40,000 and 250,000 years ago, and how the systematic errors can be as large as 800%. So all those dates earlier than, say, 40,000 years ago until you get to 250,000 years ago are our subject. Let's see. I've gone 30 minutes. You know what? I'm going to save this for a future series, but I just want to let you know very quickly, chromosome 21 shows only three haplotypes. A haplotype is a set of mutated nucleotides. Three of them describe 80% of all humans existing on planet Earth today. This is evidence that we have a recent origin, probably a lot more recent than 100,000 years ago, because if it was longer than that, we would have more than just these three haplotypes describing such a large percentage of the human species. So this indicates a recent origin. Chromosome 2 has been one of the strongest evidences published claiming that we human beings have to be the product of a common descent through naturalistic evolution, mainly because you've got the chimpanzees with an extra pair of chromosomes than we human beings. And so we lost a pair, that's the claim that's being made. And so they look at chromosome 2 in the human genome and say, it looks like the fusion of two ancestral chromosomes. And they actually cite this as evidence that therefore we must have a common ancestor with human beings. Now, if you actually read the research papers, they refer to these centromeres, those are those little blue things, and the telomeres are the red ends. And the ones at the edge, at either end of a chromosome 2 really are telomeres. The two you see in the middle, the literature says they're telomere-like. They're not exactly like telomeres, but they approximate telomeres. They may not be telomeres at all. And likewise, the two centimeters or centromeres that we see, again, are centromere-like. So it's a stretch to say that they're real centromeres and real telomeres. It's simply the appearance. And the other thing that's being overlooked here is that when we do see these kinds of fusion events happen in real time, it's never beneficial. It's always destructive. I'm trying to think of the example we have here. Down syndrome. This is an example where you have a human where you actually get a fusion event taking place. Down syndrome, they have a different number of chromosomes. And we see here is that it does have significant deleterious consequences. So whether you get a separation event or a fusion event, it's 100% deleterious where we see it happening in real time. What we've said in our book, Human Origins, is this could well be a fusion event, but it had to be a fusion event that was done by someone who has a mind that's much more intelligent and knowledgeable and technologically capable than we human beings to be able to bring about a fusion event where it doesn't have these deleterious consequences, where it either brings death or significant handicaps to the individual. Or it could be that this only looks like a fusion event. It's not a real fusion event. Vitamin C, this is another argument that's been made that we human beings are the product of common descent with the chimpanzees, because chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans, and guinea pigs, and certain fruit-eating bats do not have the ability to make vitamin C. So they claim since we share that with the great simians and great apes that share the planet with us today, we must have a common ancestor. And it's all based on the idea that the loss of being able to manufacture vitamin C is a deleterious outcome, and was a deleterious outcome, this couldn't be the product of a creator. However, vitamin C, our inability to manufacture vitamin C is actually an advantage for us. We human beings have large internal organs, and we've been designed to be able to live for 70, 80, 90 years. And if we were manufacturing our own vitamin C, the manufacturer of that vitamin C would actually damage those organs over that long of a period of time. And so we see instead is that the human body has the capacity to recycle small amounts of vitamin C that we get from our diet. And this capacity to manufacture actually has a far greater design complexity than the systems we see in animals that make their own vitamin C. So this idea this is some kind of deleterious mutation and that we lost this vitamin C manufacture, well, the counter to that is what we see in the human genome is the capacity to recycle small quantities of this vitamin C throughout the body. And that's a much more complex design feature than what it would take to manufacture the vitamin C. And manufacturing vitamin C, again, would cause way too much vitamin C to flow through the body, and we wouldn't be able to live as long as we otherwise would. Okay, I'm going to stop right there. The rest of what I got here is simply making the point that when you look at the human genome and the diversity we have, the diversity of the human genome does not tell you anything reliable about the ancestral population, because that's been another big challenge, saying that the biblical two is impossible because we got way too diverse of a human genome. There's been a number of animal experiments done, particularly on this set of islands in the South Indian Ocean, where they've taken a couple of sheep, let them breed, and then you measure their DNA generations later, and the DNA is always way more diverse than what the evolutionary models predict. And basically makes a point that when you look at these creatures, this has also been done not just on sheep, but on horses, as well as orangutans, and makes the point that we don't fully understand the relationship between present-day genetic diversity and ancestral population size, and therefore it's really a mistake to look at the genetic diversity of any mammal and try to use that as a basis for determining an ancestral population size. And I think I've already mentioned this, that when we went through the scriptures on human origins, that God could have easily have created Eve with diverse reproductive eggs, in which case that could easily account for any degree of genetic diversity that you would like. And also I would say that's possible the case too with the descent of human beings from eight individuals on board Noah's Ark. The fact that our lifespan got shortened from 900 plus years down to a maximum of 120 means that there was some kind of supernatural intervention or genome, and that also could have included the input of genetic diversity. So that I'm going to actually, I'll just finish with this. Again, a reminder that the DNA dates we get for the origin of human beings have huge error bars. It's often said in the scientific literature that mitochondrial DNA proves that we humans have been around for 300,000 years. The truth is that the best mitochondrial DNA dates we get for the origin of human beings is 150,000 years ago, plus or minus 150,000. So the error bar is literally 100%. And if you got heteroplasmy, you'd divide those numbers by 3. What is heteroplasmy? Well, 90% of us have one set of mitochondrial DNA. About 10% of us have two sets, and 1% of us have three sets. And when you take into account that not all human beings have a single set of mitochondrial DNA, but a few of us have two or three sets, when you take that into account, the date that you get through analyzing the mitochondrial DNA shrinks significantly. The date you get is that we human beings showed up 50,000 years ago, plus or minus 50,000 years. What's really important is we cannot measure any significant evolution in the mitochondrial DNA over the 40,000 year span in which we've been able to take DNA from ancient humans at different times and compare it with modern humans. When we take ancient human DNA from specimens that have been dead for 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 years ago and compare with modern day humans, we can't measure any significant evolution in the mitochondrial DNA. And then with Y chromosome, you get a date of 180,000 years ago, plus or minus 180,000 years. So again, a very large error bar there. And once again, we're not able to measure any significant change in the evolution. So I'm going to stop there. I've actually gone 40 minutes, but I really wanted to finish up our series on human origins today. So let me stop the share, and Mark will take the rest of the time for questions. And as always, I'll take questions on any subject.
Great. Thank you, Hugh. I want to remind the people in the audience that we'll be doing Q&A now, but whatever questions don't get answered today, you can resubmit them next week. And we have a 15-minute period, roughly between 10:30 and 10:45 Pacific Daylight Time, in which Hugh answers those questions before his formal presentation begins. So if you post questions today and they don't get answered, please do them next week if you want early. Or if you make sure you say after the lecture, if you want to have your questions answered, make sure to let us know that you asked the question last week and it wasn't answered. So with that, let me give Hugh the first question. From Stephen Posta, at 1 a.m. local time on June 15th, a brilliant blue fireball was seen over Pilbara in Western Australia, and many observers caught the phenomenon on video. As the fireball streaked steadily across the sky, it appeared orange or yellow, with a short tail streaming behind it. After a few seconds, the bulk of the fireball's light turned into a bright blue. Scientists aren't quite sure what object was burning up in the atmosphere to create the brilliant light show, but some indicated the blue color could have been from a large iron content. Have you seen any of these videos, and do you have an opinion as to what the object was?
Well, a fireball is any kind of large meteoroid that goes through the atmosphere. If it's more than, a quarter of a moon diameter across as it appears in the sky, we call that a fireball. I've seen a number of fireball. I've been looking at these things since I was a teenager. The biggest one I ever saw was 4 times the diameter of the moon. And by the way, the ones you really have to watch out for are the ones that don't move and get bigger and bigger with respect to time. That means it's heading right for you and you better run. But that's the biggest one I've seen. And they can change color. They can change direction because as they come into the atmosphere, they get buffeted. And I do think there's some reason to believe that there was some iron content in this meteorite that went through the atmosphere. By the way, it could be a comet. Typically, when a comet becomes a fireball, it breaks up into different pieces and can actually disappear. A lot of them don't even make it to the ground because they totally burn up. That's because bits and pieces of comets are about 85% frozen water, and the rest of it is carbonaceous material. And so they have a higher probability of burning up or breaking up in the atmosphere. Asteroids, bits of fireball, chances are it made it all the way to the Earth. And so when you do see a fireball, there's a number of astronomy organizations that want you to give a detailed report on the trajectory of the fireball and the description of its colors, the description of its size that you got to see, because they give multiple observers, they can actually triangulate and figure out where it actually landed on the Earth, and they go there and try to recover the meteorite. And of course, meteorites tell us a lot about the history of the solar system, and so there's a high demand to find these things. And in particular, if we can get to them right away, then we can actually look for more complex molecules in the meteorite without being concerned about significant contamination. Although, as I've written in our book, Origins of Life, the only way you can guarantee that there isn't a huge amount of contamination from organics on the Earth is to catch the fireball before it hits the Earth. And of course, that's not been done, but the most pristine one is one that crashed on top of a frozen lake in Canada. And because it was frozen over lake, there wasn't that much biological contamination. There was some, but not as much as you would otherwise get. So yeah, if you do see a fireball, there's a number of local professional astronomy groups that would like for you to give a detailed report. So, but this particular one, the blue color was probably caused by the cobalt, because when you got an iron meteorite, it's a meteorite that not only has a lots of iron in it, but all iron meteorites also have significant quantities of nickel and cobalt. And so, yeah, when you get these colors, typically you're getting the orange and the red colors from the carbonaceous material that's in the meteorite, but as that burns off and all that's left is the iron core, then you're going to get those blue colors. And yeah, I've actually seen these fireballs change directions. You can actually hear a sound as it comes through the atmosphere, and it can leave a significant smoke trail that lasts for many seconds afterwards.
Thank you, Hugh. We have a question from Mark Durham, an ecologist in Los Angeles area of California. In chapter 20 of your new book, Weathering Climate Change, you give many examples of practices that humans do that's harmful to Earth's atmospheric gases. Beef production is one of the most harmful. And his first question is, are there any countries taking steps to reduce that? And a follow-up is lab-grown meat a reality? And would this help reduce greenhouse gases?
Well, the kind of meat they're making in the lab, in fact, you can actually buy this in supermarkets now, where they take vegetable protein material and make it taste just like beef. I've eaten this stuff. It comes pretty close to it tastes like beef. It doesn't have quite the nutrients that beef has, but also it doesn't have all the high cholesterol saturated fats that beef has, so it's actually healthier to eat. So that's available right now. As far as being able to manufacture something from non-biological material and make it nutritious like beef and be able to eat it, I don't think that's impossible, but it hasn't been done, and it would be very expensive to do. And that's why you see the industry moving towards taking plant products and turning it into things that taste like the different kinds of meats and fishes that we like to eat. I say fish because, yeah, there's certain people love the flavor of fish. But yeah, I mean, there are certain animal proteins that you can adjust the flavor to almost anything you want. So that part is already happening. What we do notice with beef consumption, it does pump huge amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere because when you raise beef for milk, and it's not just meat, but milk as well, milk, cheese, and beef, you do release large quantities of methane and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So a lot of people have been saying, is there some way we can reduce human beef consumption? What's happening right now is beef consumption is actually going up and not down. Because what's happening is that nations of the world where the wealth level was not high enough for people could afford to eat that meat now is. I mean, some good examples of that would be India and China. Their economies are now robust enough that large segments of the population can now actually afford to consume beef. And this has greatly increased the demand for beef. And so beef consumption is actually going up. But yes, there are a lot of people saying we need to find some way to bring it down. And one suggestion I made in weathering climate change is that if we were to replace beef in terms of meat with ostrich meat. Ostrich meat is a very, it's a red meat. It's very rich in iron. All the nutrients that beef has, you also get in ostrich meat, but with big advantages. You don't get the saturated fat. You don't have the high cholesterol content. All the bad stuff in beef, you don't find in ostrich meat. In fact, ostrich meat is much healthier to eat than chicken or turkey. It's really about the healthiest meat you can get. And it's actually recommended for people that have certain kinds of diabetic disorders that need to get that. And therefore, there's been a lot of talk, well, gee, we can transfer dependence from beef to ostrich meat. And ostriches have the advantages that they release less than 2% of the greenhouse gases that beef release for per pound of meat. You don't need the amount of pasture land. You can get by with much more land usage for ostriches than you can for beef. However, a lot of ostrich ranches have failed, especially here in North America. And they have failed because the ranchers think that they can treat the ostriches like they do the cows. One of the advantages of raising cows for meat is that you can just let them loose in a pasture land and not worry about them. They can take care of themselves against predators. They can handle wide extremes of climate, and they don't need human contact. That's not true of ostriches. They bond quite strongly to human beings, and when they don't have that social contact with one another and with humans, they suffer, their health suffers. So they can't be raised the same way they can, but the potential is out there. That if we were to really scale up the production of ostrich meat, number one, you also get eggs. One ostrich egg is the equivalent of 22 chicken eggs. So that's another source of a food supply we could get from ostriches. And it's actually possible that the price of ostrich meat could be driven to half the price of turkey, which is now the cheapest meat that you can get in the market. So ostrich meat potentially could be the cheapest meat on the market. It'd be the healthiest meat. And so it's an example where everybody wins. The greenhouse gas emission is minimized. We can actually scale up where you could have a lot of inexpensive meat available. So more people in the world can be eating meat than they're eating right now. Although there are a number of people saying we should also be encouraging an increase in plant protein use. But you can do both.
Thank you, Hugh. Susan Lambeau asks whether the all the hominid species that you were mentioning had a population less than 10,000.
Okay, we do know the population numbers for Neanderthals and Denisovans. I mentioned that, I think it was last week or the week before, that they're a neighborhood of 3,000 to 10,000 total on the face of the earth. The total numbers at maximum got to 25,000. Somebody has been speculating, meaning gotten that high, but most anthropologists believe it never got past 9,000 individuals, stayed between 3,000 and 9,000. And we don't have the same certainty on the numbers for, say, the Homo erectus, Homo habilis, Heidelbergensis, and the Australopithecines. But what we see there in terms of the artifacts we're finding and the geographical locations is it looks a lot like what we're finding for the more recent Denisovans and the Neanderthals. So this is why there's now a growing consensus in the scientific literature that their population levels likewise had to be small, likely in the thousands, not the millions. And likely we're looking at them being in the small locales. So just like how the Neanderthals were not filling the whole part of Europe at one time and Western Siberia, but just little tiny pockets. And how we're also finding, just like with the Neanderthals and the Denisovans, the evidence seems limited to caves. That'd be another piece of evidence that the population levels were quite low. But again, because it's so much earlier in time, the conclusions aren't as strong as what we got for the Neanderthals and the Denisovans. And yeah, Susan's got a follow-up. I'd be happy to take it.
Thank you, Hugh. Osuo Ayim asks, what would you consider to be the most convincing argument or evidence against Darwinian evolution?
Well, one that's hardly ever raised as a challenge to naturalistic evolution. And I say naturalistic as opposed to Darwinian, because most evolution biologists today insist that they're not talking about Darwinian evolution. It's somewhat similar. I mean, they're still talking evolutionary change through mutations, natural selection, but they add gene exchange. And they make the point too, we now know that certain parts of the evolution is non-random as opposed to being 100% random, like is being assumed in Darwinian evolution. But yeah, one I've raised that I've yet to meet an evolutionary biologist who's even taken this into account is the faint sun paradox. I'm actually going to be giving a talk on the faint sun paradox this Thursday for RTB Live. And that will be recorded. So if you can't get there at 1 p.m. Pacific, you can watch the recording on YouTube on our Reasons to Believe YouTube channel. It will appear there within a day or two. And the point I'm going to be making in this talk is that we astronomers know that the sun today is about 23% brighter than it was at the origin of life on planet Earth. We also know that life on planet Earth can only tolerate about a 1% change in the brightness level of the sun. And therefore, we need a mind that knows the future physics of the sun to know which life to remove from planet Earth and which new life to replace it with. Because what we see in the fossil record is that we see a progression of life forms that is progressively more efficient at pulling greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere than the previous species, and explains why the fossil record is filled with all this evidence for mass extinction events followed by mass speciation events. The advantage of the mass extinction event, it removes from the planet these species of life that are less efficient at removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere and permit the replacement of those species with a mass speciation event where we now have species of life that are more efficient at just the right level to pull out the additional greenhouse gases of the atmosphere. I talk about this in some depth in my book, Improbable Planet, where I make the point that in terms of trying to keep up with the changing physics of the sun, you would need one of these mass extinction events followed by a mass speciation event to happen about once every 30 to 35 million years. And interestingly, that's exactly what you see in the fossil record, that we get about that periodicity of mass extinction events followed by mass speciation events. And there's actually biblical support for this. It's in Psalm 104, verses 29 and 30. Verse 29, the psalmist says it's the property of all life to die off. Verse 30, but God recreates and renews the face of the earth with different species of life. But my whole point is, if this was naturalistic evolution, it would quickly get out of sync with the changing physics of the sun. And incidentally, I would add the physics of the earth changes. The atmospheric physics changes. The physics of the moon changes. And so you need a creator with a mind that knows what the future physics of the sun will be, the earth will be, and the moon will be, to ensure we have just the right life on planet Earth at just the right time and just the right quantity and diversity and geographical locations to perfectly compensate for all the changing physics of the sun, earth, and moon. And so my whole point is we need to do an integrated, interdisciplinary approach to really understand the history of life on planet Earth. And when you bring the physics and astronomy and the geophysics to bear, I think you get a very powerful case against naturalistic explanations from life evolving from the first life form up to us human beings.
Thank you, Hugh. Also, Waim also asks, if the Neanderthals are different species, how come they were able to interbreed with humans, whereas animals of different species do not naturally interbreed?
Well, we do see the capability of different species being able to interbreed. I mean, for example, it's possible for a polar bear and a grizzly bear to breed. They don't do it, but when you put them in a zoo where they got no other options, it's been known to happen. Likewise, a lion and a tiger can breed and produce offspring. So this does happen with our species. And moreover, we see some biblical reference to this, because in the book of Leviticus, we human beings are commanded to avoid bestiality, to avoid having sexual contact with non-human animals. And you know, why would that be there? Well, number one, I think, is to prevent the progression of disease, but number two, to ensure that we don't get unwanted offspring. One important caveat, there's a lot in the scientific literature providing evidence that there was a very limited amount of sexual contact between humans and Neanderthals where they may have given viable offspring. I want to remind everybody that the evidence is there, so it's not insignificant evidence, but neither is it compelling evidence. And there's been debate going on between our scholars at Reasons to Believe on just how certain this evidence for interbreeding is. I've heard Fazal Rana, our staff biochemist, claim he believes there's an 80% probability that this interbreeding did take place. But the physical anthropologist, Sue Dykes, said, that's the other way around for me. I'm 80% persuaded it did not happen. And her comment was that, you know, this idea that we have shared deleterious features with the Neanderthals may not be true at all. Where we do see the shared features between Europeans and the Neanderthals may have everything to do with the fact that they were both living in a place where they don't get a lot of sunlight and the geography there. So she's actually claiming that there's evidence for shared deleterious characteristics really is evidence for shared beneficial characteristics and therefore wouldn't qualify as evidence for interbreeding. That's a debate that's going on, but I'm comfortable either way because I can see what we, you know, I mean, the fact that we have the sons of God coming down and having intercourse with the daughters of men in Genesis chapter 6 actually is a biblical example of an interspecies bestiality. I've argued that that may actually be a reference to demons having intercourse with women because of what I see in Jude chapter 6 about angels who left their estate. That would be a reference to bestiality. So the fact that we actually see these references in the Bible means this is not out of the realm of biological possibility. And so if it did happen biologically, I'm okay with that because the papers that are published do have the important caveat that if this evidence is real, the level of interbreeding was at an extremely low level, such an extremely low level that we can be confident from a biblical perspective that the image of God was protected. But I think we can also discern from a biblical perspective that given Satan's a battle with God, that he would be highly motivated to try to instigate this kind of interbreeding as a strategy to try to damage the image of God. But the evidence we see in the papers is even if it's real, it has no lasting damage on the image of God. We're talking maybe one or two generations only being affected.
Thank you, Hugh. We have a question from Stephen Posta from Spring, Texas. On page 175 of Weathering Climate Change, you make a brief reference to the Gaian bottleneck and its importance as a prerequisite to a planet's habitable zone. Please elaborate on an explanation of what exactly is the Gaian bottleneck, and that's spelled G-A-I-A-N. Yep.
I'm aware of that, and I may actually have to get the book down and look at that. It was based on a paper that was published, that much I remember. Page 175. Thank you for giving me the page number. Ah, here it is. Oh yeah, interesting paper, and the reason why I cited it is it makes an important concession, namely that life on planet Earth plays a significant role in regulating the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere, regulating the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and that's important in the context of the fact that our star, the sun, is getting brighter and brighter. And so the Gaian bottleneck is really a reference to the fact that we had to come up with some explanation for the longevity of life on planet Earth. And that typically what happens is you get this bottleneck, and Gaia actually refers to how life on a planet regulates the environment for that life. And basically this paper is making the point that life is going to have a problem being able to regulate the environment sufficiently that that life can remain for a long time on planet Earth. So the Gaian bottleneck is basically a reference to the fact that you're only going to have a limited amount of time in which life can exist on a planet, because there's only a limited amount of time that life from a naturalistic perspective is going to be able to alter the atmosphere and the water vapor content in such a way to ensure the longevity of life. The thing that this paper is overlooking wasn't written by people who are theists. It was written by scientists who are non-theists. But from a theistic perspective, if you've got God controlling the life, actually removing life from the planet and replacing it with just right life at just right times, you can overcome the Gaian bottleneck. Because now you've got a creator making sure we've got just the right life. And part of what was in this paper too is in order to regulate the environment, the greenhouse gases in the environment, and particularly the water vapor, you need a whole lot of very diverse life on planet Earth. And the probability of that happening is remote. It's remote unless we're talking a supernatural creator who designed our planet in a supernatural way that it can sustain a huge quantity of life, a huge biomass, and a huge biodiversity for a long period of time. And something I mentioned both in Weathering Climate Change and Improbable Planet, the amazing thing about a planet Earth is the fact that it's been designed to sustain the necessary biomass and biodiversity that you can actually maintain a perfect compensation for the changing physics of our star, the sun. But this paper is making the point that what's true of our sun is true of all stars. In fact, when you go to stars that are not like our star, the sun, it becomes a far greater problem. And so there's a reason why God chose a star like our sun, because a star like our sun, you've got the possibility of having a huge abundance of life on a single planet that's diverse enough that you can keep up with the changing physics of that star. That wouldn't be the case if you're looking at a star that's not exactly like our star, the sun. I'm actually writing a chapter on that right now for my next book, Interior Designs, making the point that if you want life, you're going to need a star exactly like our sun, a star that has very little flaring activity and has a window of time when it's exactly middle age where it has the conditions that would allow for the existence of us human beings. Anyway, like all the papers I cite, and Weathering Climate Change, I give you a link to the research paper. if you go to the endnotes, you'll see that every paper I cite there, I give you the DOI. That DOI is a label adopted by the scientific community, where if you type that in, it automatically pops up the paper, and you can read that paper for yourself and see what it's saying. The abstract is typically designed to be understood by people who are non-experts, and the policy in the scientific community is that the abstracts of every published paper is available to the entire public free of charge. Often they want money if you want to read the rest of the paper, although more and more I notice that scientific journals are only asking for money if the paper has been published within the previous 2 years. If it's older than 2 years, they make the entire paper available to the public. And here's a little inside tip, is that the preprints on which the published papers are based are also available in their entirety to the public. So if you don't want to pay the $30 or $35 charge to read the paper, you can actually get the preprint and read it at no charge. And if that preprint's been published, chances are it doesn't differ that much from what you see in the peer-reviewed journal. However, it's always good to check. I mean, I have often done that. I'll read the preprint on the ARXIV website, and then I see some things, and I say, I better get the actual paper. So in that case, I'll pony up and pay the money. But I'm a Scots, so I try to avoid paying money every chance I get.
Thank you, Hugh. Hugh then asks, nowadays, secular scientists seem to improvise their argument by saying that the concept of missing fossil records is a misleading one. They further add on that a transitional form does not need to be a perfect halfway. Life does not progress up a hierarchical order from low to high, but is a branching bush. What are your opinions?
Well, those are good questions. I've addressed all that in the book More Than a Theory, where I take on the whole model of evolution. Incidentally, I think in September 1, Faisal Rana and A.J. Roberts, and Mark, I think you got a chapter in the book too. We got five chapters from Sue Dykes. Our book on evolution is going to be coming out then, which goes into this in much more detail than what I put in More Than a Theory. But in More Than a Theory, I made the point that there is evidence for transitions in the fossil record, but they show up for the wrong species at the wrong time. I mean, if you're really trying to claim that some kind of naturalistic evolutionary process is producing these transitional forms, then we would expect to see them most frequently for species of life that have the largest populations, that have the shortest generation times. What I mean by that is the shortest period of time between being born and being able to reproduce, that have got the simplest protein biochemistry, that have the greatest number of progeny per adult. I list about 12 factors in More Than a Theory that would be predictors for how efficiently a particular species would produce these transitional forms. But the bottom line is we would expect this to work really well for certain kinds of insects, ants and termites in particular. We should see this all over the place. And where we should see it least frequently is for the whales, because whales have huge body sizes, the population levels are low, they're mammals with complex proteins, they have very few progeny per adult, and they got a long generation time. However, what's interesting, when you read the textbooks on transitional forms, their best example is the whales. And yet that's the opposite of what we predict in terms of what the models tell us would be the drivers for these transitional forms. But it raises an issue, okay, if this is actually evidence for a creator, why do we see all these apparent transitional forms for the whales, and why do we see so few for termites and ants and cockroaches? The number one, from a creator's perspective, he can create a cockroach and know that that cockroach is going to survive quite well on its own for about a quarter of a billion years. So the Creator doesn't need to be making a lot of new and distinct species, advanced termites and cockroaches. They can last a long time once they show up on the scene. Interestingly, though, we do see several new species of ants showing up in the last 50 million years. And like, so that's kind of an enigma. Why so few before and why so many afterwards? And I make the point in Improbable Planet that if you look at these new species of ants that show up on the scene and look at all the whale species, and we're looking at about 60, quote, transitions for the whales, it's exactly what you'd want from a Creator's perspective to compensate for the changing physics of the sun. Because these new ant species we show up that apparently come out of nowhere, these are ant species that are far more efficient at pulling greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. And therefore, they actually play a role in, as the sun gets brighter and brighter, in keeping the temperature in the surface of the Earth optimal. Likewise with the whales. We now know that whales fertilize the phytoplankton on the face of the Earth, both the freshwater phytoplankton and the saltwater phytoplankton. And as you look at all these different transitions, they're happening at a pace that actually contributes significantly to the reduction of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and simultaneously into stimulating the population of phytoplankton. And since the phytoplankton are the base of the ocean food chain, have actually been stimulating the increased diversity and biomass of a fish throughout the oceans. And so from a Creator's perspective, I can see why there'd be all these new species of whales showing up. And moreover, if you look at whales as a species, we realize they have the highest probability of going extinct. In fact, there have been papers published making the point that the maximum time a whale species can survive on the face of the Earth is roughly a million years, somewhere between half a million years and a couple of million years. And therefore, for that reason alone, we would see the need for the Creator making new species of whales and making those species of whales in such a way that they can begin to move from freshwater into the estuaries along the coastal, and then finally into all the oceans of the world. And so the spreading of whales that we see and the different morphological features of the whales makes sense from that perspective. And especially makes sense when we realize that whales have the lowest probability of evolutionary change of any animal we see on the face of the Earth.
Thank you, Hugh. Doug McComb asks about a creation.com article that he references, that you claim that science alone could drive men to a correct understanding of our origin on this planet and hence the necessity of a Creator. Would you like to address this claim of theirs? It seems like they often misrepresent your stance.
Well, they do, and they're young Earth creationists, and they basically are making the point that you really can't trust the record of nature to reveal truth. We need to only look at the Bible for the ultimate source of truth. So I argue that they misinterpret the Reformation doctrine of sola scriptura. Sola scriptura is making the point that the Bible and the Bible alone is a reliable revelation from God. But they add this important caveat that it's a verbal revelation. The record of nature is not a verbal revelation. It's not words, literal words. Although it's interesting, in Psalm 19, it talks about the record of nature metaphorically as being like a book. And so we actually see this in Article 2 of the Belgic Confession, how God has revealed himself through two books, the book of nature and the book of scripture, and how the book of nature is like a written book where all the creatures and the different components of creation are analogous to words and sentences and paragraphs and books. So the very fact that that analogy is used both in Psalm 19 and in the Belgic Confession makes the point that what God reveals in nature is reliable. So I personally believe that the what we see in the Bible, the words of the Bible, are inspired and inerrant, and we get an inerrant revelation through the 66 books of the Bible, but I also argue we get an inerrant revelation through the record of nature. The people of creation.com and other young earth creationists try to counter that by saying that with the fall of Adam, the record of nature became corrupted, where it's no longer capable of revealing truth to human beings that it was before. And what they're overlooking there, in my opinion, is that the fall that took place in the Garden of Eden does indeed damage our ability to interpret what's revealed in the record of nature, and for that matter, in the book of Scripture. A lot of people, I believe, are reading Scripture and they're misinterpreting in such a way that they wind up getting a faulty or at least a distorted interpretation. But I stand by what I've written in my books, namely that God does faithfully and inerrantly reveal himself through both the book of nature and the book of Scripture. But I wholeheartedly endorse the doctrine of sola scriptura, that the Bible is the only verbal revelation, that God is the only verbal written revelation. Of course, we got a verbal revelation when Jesus of Nazareth was here in the face of the earth. But in terms of a verbal written revelation, it's the Bible and the Bible alone. So I hold to that, but that doesn't mean that it's the only revelation. Otherwise, how could Romans 1 be true, where it says everyone is without excuse because God's revealed himself and his attributes through the record of nature? And as I've indicated in my book on Job, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, the basic outline of the message of redemption is also revealed in the book of nature. We can determine by looking at nature that there must be a God, that this God must be all powerful, all knowledgeable, all wise, and all loving. And then God has written his law in the heart of every human being. That's part of the natural revelation. As Job pointed out, when we look at that law that's been written on our hearts, we realize we can't live up to that law. But if God's all loving, he must have provided a means by which we can be delivered from what we're not able to deliver ourselves, which is why, independent of any written record of Scripture, Job was able to declare, I know that there's a Redeemer. I know I have an advocate on high, someone who can take care of my propensity to rebel against God. And because I'm depending on that, I know I will see God when I'll see him in my flesh at the, you know. So he's basically declaring the assurance of his salvation. It's actually part of the musical, The Messiah, Job 19, where Job declares, I know that my Redeemer lives, and I will see him with my own eyes, and my flesh I will see him, referring to the fact that there will be life after death.
Thank you, Hugh. We're done with our recording session now. We have two questions pending, but I'll ask the two questioners to please submit them next week. We'll be happy to answer them then. You can pose them either between 10:30 and 10:45 Pacific Daylight Time before our formal lecture, or afterwards as we did it today. So with that, Hugh, we're done, and you can close us out if you wish.
I will. And so next week, we'll launch a short series on weathering climate change and its biblical implications. And that will hold us, I think, until the time we're actually able to begin in-person meetings again. But again, this is not going to discontinue. We're going to continue with the live streaming capability and the recording like we've been doing for the past 3 or 4 years. But let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for this time we've had today. And thank you, Lord, that you saw fit to create us human beings and to use us human beings as a tool to bring about the end of all evil and suffering, not just for our benefit, but for the benefit of the angelic realm as well, and for whatever new creatures you may create in the new creation. And Father, I pray that you would give us opportunities to be ambassadors of your message. Lord, that the new creation is such a wonderful place. Lord, motivate us to encourage as many people as possible to take advantage of your offer of redemption. And thank you, Lord, for the privilege of allowing us to live in the 21st century, where literally on a daily basis, we can see new evidences for your existence and your plan of salvation. So, Father, I pray that you would keep us curious and keep us motivated. Most of all, Lord, help us to submit to the work of your Holy Spirit, that day by day we can grow in the character of Christ. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you. So with that, I'm going to end the recording, and we'll see all of you next week. And again, if you've got questions, feel free to get them ready. We'll actually...